Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Maritime Museum. With Turning the Tide, the role of Manitowoc's landing craft tanks in World War II, an exhibit exploring Manitowoc's role in the war and D-Day. WisconsinMaritime.org.
The way was opened up for folks with bravery. Oh, there were plenty of fights to win land rights, but the West was meant to be. It was a manifest destiny. The trappers, traders, and the peddlers, the politicians and the settlers, they got there by any way they could.
Any way they could.
The gold rush trampled down the wilderness. The railroads spread across from east to west, and soon the rest was opened up for.
The Schoolhouse Rock song talks of manifest destiny and the way we claimed more elbow room as part of America's superiority. What kind of neighbor have we been? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. When we say America, we mean the United States of America, but that ignores our position as a neighbor to about 30 other nation states in Latin or South America. How has racism and imperialism shaped our concept of what it means to be American? My guest is Krista Olson, professor and chair of the University of Wisconsin-Madison English Department and the author most recently of American Magnitude, Hemispheric Vision and Public Feeling in the United States. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your title, American Magnitude.
Mm-hmm. So the title actually, as book titles do, they develop over time, they change. I cannot remember the earlier titles, but magnitude became a really important concept for me coming from my own location academically as a rhetorician. Rhetoric talks about magnitude as the way that people grant importance to anything.
So, and just to clarify, when you say that you're in this area of rhetoric and are a rhetorician, you're looking at the way we speak, the way we use language to persuade, or can you give me a kind of thumbnail definition
so
of that?
That is the way people speak and use language, but also use their bodies, use images, even use spaces to persuade and shape behaviors. So as a rhetorician, which is a ridiculous word, but a rhetorician, I am particularly interested in visual and material culture. When I'm teaching, I often have students think about spaces on campus that have shaped how they behave. So for example, if folks have ever visited campus, college library lets people to just walk in. You can walk in whenever you want and get a book. And Memorial Library, the big central library, has gates, and you have to show an ID, and you can't just walk in. And College Library is supposed to be mostly for undergraduate students. It's supposed to be a place to come and study. And Memorial Library is a place for serious scholarship, and you have to be a member of the university to access those books. And the space of those two buildings is built to suggest that, to kind of teach you who you're supposed to be when you walk in. And so when I say rhetoric, I actually mean even the design of the architecture that shapes our behavior when we walk into those spaces. And that's the kind of thing that interests me as much or maybe even more than a speech by a president who's trying to persuade people to vote for them.
And so with your book, American Magnitude, focused pretty much on south of the border and the way Central America or South America, and what we've done in terms of images and wars and pictures, films, how that has helped to shape our concept of who we are. Why did you choose that topic? What interested you or kind of made you think about writing a book-length, you know, study on this topic?
Yeah. My first book is about Ecuadorian nationalism. So it looks at the role of images in the creation of an idea of what it means to be Ecuadorian. And while I was doing the research for that book, I came across the story of Frederick Edwin Church, who was a 19th century U.S. painter who traveled to the Andes in the 19th century in 1853 and 1857. And he traveled to the Andes and he painted the Andes. And while he was there, he met with a lot of artists. And the sort of classic story in Ecuadorian art history is that Frederick Church taught Ecuadorians how to do landscape painting. And I was always suspicious of that. It didn't quite seem right that one guy shows up and suddenly Ecuadorians know how to do landscape painting.
Sounds a little paternalistic.
And so I was curious about that. And it didn't fit in the first project, but it stuck with me. And I found myself looking for and gathering other examples of times when things like that had happened. And so actually the first title of the book was The Persuasions of Travel. And so it was what I was looking at, what people from the U.S. learned when they went to Latin America. But what I began to see, getting back to your question about the title, is that what people from the U.S. tended to learn was something about themselves. And they tended to think about themselves as bigger and better and grander. And they even would start to use images of big, grand, amazing things in South America as evidence of their own country's greatness.
You talk in one of your chapters about someone's discovery, and I put that in air quotes, but discovery of Machu Picchu.
Or, yes.
You know, the same with the Andes, almost as if the American painter discovered this volcano or this mountain range or something. So that's what you're talking about, is where Americans almost lay claim to something that wasn't even part of the United States.
Yes, exactly. So with Frederick Church, somebody describing his painting, Heart of the Andes. So this is a U.S. 19th century art reviewer who describes Church's painting, which is, it's not a painting of the mountain Chimborazo, which was then thought to be the highest mountain in the world. But it is a painting where Chimborazo is sort of supposed to be the mountain in it. And then somebody's describing this painting of a mountain that's south of the equator. And he says, it has a Yankee sensibility. And he's sort of describing the painting, but more than that, he's describing the scene and the place as having a Yankee sensibility. And you get this sense that he's kind of claiming it. And in fact, somebody else, another critic says, it's ours. You get the sense that it's ours. So they were really explicitly laying claim, although they didn't want the territory. They had no interest in conquering Ecuador. They just wanted the grandeur.
Well, and they did have interest in conquering a lot of land back in the United States, if we look at the topic of your first chapter, which really focuses on the U.S.-Mexico War and James Polk and other things that happened with Manifest Destiny. Maybe we could hear just a little clip. Tell me what we're going to hear where it's referring to James Polk.
So this is a song by They Might Be Giants called James K. Polk. And it's essentially the story of his running for president. And somebody shared this song with me when I was working on the Mexican War chapter, because I made some comment about James K. Polk being my least favorite president. And they said, oh, have you heard the James K. Polk song? And played it for me. As Polk is kind of a quiet figure in the chapter, but he's there in the background because he's the one driving the Mexican War for the purely for the sake of getting that territory, getting California.
Let's hear a little bit of that song. That came up in the song and that you refer to quite a bit in your book, Manifest Destiny.
Yeah. So Manifest Destiny first appeared as a term in John O'Sullivan's United States Magazine and Democratic Review. And for a long time, it was given, O'Sullivan himself was given credit for it. Most recently, as my understanding goes, it's actually attributable to Jane McManus Storm, who's also known as Cora Montgomery. So actually a woman coined the term. And they were talking about the reality in their mind, in her mind and other folks' minds, that the United States would inevitably extend all the way to California. And this was very much in line at this moment, the time when she coins it, it's in line with the U.S. annexing Texas. So that it is inevitable that the U.S. will take Texas and then we'll have California. But of course, even if Texas could have been said to have by its own volition separated from Mexico and joined the United States, California in that moment belonged to Mexico. And there was all this discussion, which you hear in all kinds of imperialist narratives over the years, right, that Mexico wasn't making good use of California, and therefore really the United States could make better use of it. But they couldn't just take it. There was no movement in California as there was in Texas to take that land and to move to the U.S. And so James Polk needed a war that he could win. And Polk and all of the U.S., they were so sure. And this is why I'm interested in as a rhetorician, right? How were they persuaded that California belonged to them? How did they persuade other people to believe that? And how did they persuade themselves that it would be easy to get it? And so the United States and Mexico were having a border dispute. They didn't agree where the U.S. border should be. And what happened with the start of the U.S.-Mexican War is that that the U.S. went into territory it claimed as its own, but that Mexico claimed it as its own also. And Mexico went into that same territory. And of course, they both thought the other had invaded, and the war started. And so nobody had to say that they declared war. And James K. Polk did everything he could to do just enough to seem like he was trying to avoid a war, while also poking Mexico as hard as he could. And the Mexican governments of this time are not exactly angelic governments. They were pokeable in very mm-hmm. clear ways. But the United States really thought they could win this war within a battle or two. And they didn't. It dragged on and on. It was a terrible war. It's one of those forgotten wars. Mm-hmm. People confuse it with the Spanish-American War,
which was later.
And it gets completely sort of subsumed by the Civil War. A lot of the generals and soldiers who got famous in the Civil War actually started in the U.S.-Mexican War. There was this constant idea of we're going to win this. It's going to be easy. And it wasn't. And there was the regular army, which was really poorly thought of and well-trained. And then the volunteers, which were essentially frontiersmen who volunteered. I did a lot of the research for this book in the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library because a lot of the volunteers were from places like Illinois. They're from the frontier. They had this idea of manifest destiny, of the land that belonged to them. And so they went, and they weren't very well-trained, and they didn't want to do like things that seemed silly to them, like maintain clean camps. And so the death rates were astonishing from fighting, but especially from camp illnesses. Mm-hmm. And so I believe it's only the Civil War, if you count the casualties on both sides, only the Civil War has had a higher percentage of loss. And if the effects were terrible for the U.S., they were devastating for Mexico because they fought and they fought. And the people rose up against the U.S. because the U.S. was invading their land, but they were not well equipped. They were not well led. And so it was a terrible war. And California was supposed to be ours, you know, naturally and easily, mm-hmm. but it really wasn't. But we forget that.
And you write about how Mexico lost about half of its land.
Yeah.
During this war. It is interesting how that war is just sort of glossed over.
Right.
I remember seeing a mention of it in Thoreau's Civil Disobedience. One of the reasons he didn't pay his taxes is he didn't want to support that war or slavery.
Yes.
And when you look at the story of American magnitude, the spread of America, the kind of conquest of the whole country, it is a story of racism and imperialism. There's not really a way around the what happened to indigenous people yeah. or to the people south of the border. Was part of your interest in writing this book showing that the sort of I guess, the negative side that we maybe gloss over in history books about how we became America and how we think of ourselves?
You know, we're at this strange moment in history where many of us have access to more knowledge about our history and more awareness of its deep roots in colonialism and racism than perhaps was widely spread in conversation. And yet we are also at this moment when the fear of that, the fear of sharing that news, of recognizing that racism and recognizing the, you know, the ongoing colonial situation of a lot of Mexican Americans and Chicano people in the southwest of the United States, what used to be Mexico's northwest, you know, there's a fear that if we acknowledge that, if people have to say, yes, this is what happened, that somehow we're not as great as we thought we were. And I guess what drives the book in that sense is, do we really need to be great, exceptional, to be good, to be hopeful, to imagine a world that can be better for everyone? I'm not sure that we need to be special in the world to also make a difference in the world.
Can you talk, you do this some in your introduction, about even our term American and the way we use that as if somehow there aren't these other parts of the Americas? How did that come to be?
Yeah, I will admit that when I started the project, I was curious and tracking down where exactly does that happen? And it doesn't happen in one moment. And I don't have a final answer for this is when it happened. Part of it is a simple, because the United States chose United States of America as the name, that makes the ending, you know, just like Mexico is the United States of Mexico and they're Mexico. So that's part of it. Part of it's just sheer semantics. But it's also that the U.S. plays an outsized role in this hemisphere and has for at least since the early 19th century, since Monroe's doctrine, has placed itself as kind of the most American of the Americas and therefore kind of claiming that central place. Latin Americans tend to acquiesce to that, but also roll their eyes at it and comment on the sort of it's a metonymy for the arrogance of the United States in some ways, that we get to be America, and okay, fine, we'll let you have that, but also you're just acting like yourselves by having it. So I think that's it's become the norm, but it's not because nobody notices the ridiculousness of it.
And can you comment a little bit about our differential treatment of Canada versus all the neighbors to the south?
Yeah.
And to what extent racism plays into that?
To a huge extent. But I also think it's easier to be uniquely American among Americans if we mostly focus on our neighbors to the south because of major cultural differences.
You write that sometimes we've used them as a foil.
Yeah.
How so?
So, sometimes Latin America is our other, right? They're, oh, look, you know, we're so successful and they send their people to us, right? So that's a really common framing. A lot of this book is about the opposite, the ways that the United States has gone to South America in various sorts of need and the ways that South Americans have both been exploited, but also in some ways stepped up to participate in creating that a relationship. I would say that the best chapter to illustrate this is my chapter about Walt Disney and the Office of Inter-American Affairs at the State Department in the 1940s.
I found that a fascinating chapter. I didn't know that Walt Disney had worked on things with the American government with Latin America in mind, and we'll talk about that when we return in a moment with the University of the Year.
Here, amigos, Donald, Jose. Caramba! Now we're three gay caballeros. Yeah! We're three caballeros, three gay caballeros. They say we are birds of a feather. We're hop. Y amigos, no matter where he goes, the one, two, and three goes, we're always together. We're three happy chappies with snappy serappies. You'll find us beneath our sombreros. We're brave and we'll stay so. We're bright as a peso. We say so, the three caballeros.
That's from The Three Caballeros from 1944, featuring Donald Duck, a Brazilian parrot, and a Mexican rooster. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Krista Olson. We are talking about her book, American Magnitude, Hemispheric Vision and Public Feeling in the United States. It wasn't until I read the chapter in your book about animated interests that I realized that Walt Disney got involved with the American government in terms of propaganda films for Central and South America. That was news to me.
Yes. So Disney, some 90% of Disney's production time during World War II went to U.S. government projects. They helped make training films for soldiers. They did propaganda in the U.S. And they played this major role in Central and South America, in part because Disney had a great reputation. Central and South America government, but also popular culture, felt like Disney was a great person. And they... Disney actually produced films with Spanish, not just dubbed, but actually like made the Spanish available. And that was unusual at the time. And so people appreciated that he thought of them as a market and when he sent their films, sent Disney's films to South America. And so there's kind of positive feeling about Disney. And when the U.S. government felt the need to sort of get Latin America on its side.
Because they were afraid that the Axis powers would somehow get inroads there?
Germany obviously was a concern, but in some ways it was more Franco-Spain that was considered the risk.
Spanish language connection.
The Spanish language, mm-hmm. but also the Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So conservative Latin Americans were receptive to Franco's conservative Catholic ideology. And that then opened the door for other fascist ideologies and recruitment. And so there was a concern that Latin America was vulnerable in a way that the United States was not to Axis propaganda. This, of course, again, back to racism, right? The idea that Catholicism is an especially problematic religion, deeply woven into this. But actually, in his famous Arsenal of Democracy speech, Franklin Delano Roosevelt talks about the danger of the Axis getting a base in Latin America. And so there's this concern. We need to wrap our arms around Latin America and make sure that they're on our side. And so a huge campaign of development, of propaganda, of military support, and of just good neighbor outreach for the FDR notion of the good neighbor policy, right? Is aiming to get Central and South America in a good relationship with the U.S.
And then enters Walt Disney.
And so Disney, because of that good relationship that Disney already had, was seen as the perfect person to help do that. And so Disney went on a bunch of goodwill tours and helped out with creating these two feature-length films, The Three Caballeros and Saludos Amigos, which are both available on YouTube if you want to watch the whole thing, also on Disney Plus. And those two feature-length films, as well as a whole lot of shorts that were distributed. And this is the thing that got me into working on Disney, a set of literacy films where Donald Duck and the Disney characters would teach reading and writing to illiterate Spanish audiences. And it was a debacle. It was a ridiculous program. But Disney came out of it unscathed because people blamed the U.S. government. People in Mexico and the rest of Latin America blamed the U.S. government. So this all gets to The Three Caballeros, the three cowboys. The movie Three Caballeros makes references to cowboy culture in Argentina and in the United States as a way to draw connections, as well as a whole bunch of other possible connections. But Panchito Pistola is the Mexican rooster in there. And there's some really lovely archival evidence of how the Mexican media responded to the creation of Panchito Pistola and his role, and sort of this claiming of a bit of like, oh yeah, we gave this. And yes, that's a pretty accurate, like, that's a pretty good play on Mexican culture. Not like it's a true sense of Mexican culture, but that they appreciate it as an animated version.
So they didn't see it as a stereotype or as a negative?
There were others. So in the literacy films, for example, there are terrible stereotypes of Jose and Ramon, who are deeply, deeply rooted in the most racist of anti-Mexican stereotypes. Panchito Pistola, at least the elites who were writing newspaper columns, found him to be a fun sort of character and weren't treating him as a problem. But they also didn't see him as something that the U.S. was giving or something that made them particularly close to the U.S. Instead, they tended to see these films as evidence of their own contributions to these ideas of America. And so they weren't willing to be in the subordinate position.
It made them feel proud rather than sort of...
Right.
Admiring of greatness elsewhere.
Yeah. So the line I often use in this chapter is that the United States, especially the State Department, using Disney, wanted Latin Americans to look to the United States, to look to the United States for guidance, for leadership, for a sense of what good culture was. And more often what happened in this era is that the Latin American countries looked at the United States and they assessed what they saw. And they saw somebody who they could occasionally partner with. They saw somebody who could provide them with a fun film. And they saw a country that had all the foibles that you might think the United States has now, including arrogance. And so I describe it as looking askance. Mm-hmm. So they didn't look to the United States so much as looking askance at the United States, which is not what the State Department was wanting, but also wasn't a hostile relationship. It was a relationship of asserting of their own authority to be American countries on their own, not needing to cede power to the U.S. in every front.
You write about the fact that the ending of those movies had the line, "This is what Uncle Sam has done for Latin America," and that Disney opposed ending films with that line, but that the American government wouldn't cover the costs otherwise.
So those were the literacy films that had that. So the feature films didn't, because Disney... He didn't fully cover the cost because the State Department paid for some of the tours, but those were mm-hmm. Disney films. The literacy films, part of the controversy in the moment. So I should say there were three Mexican teachers who were originally invited to be part of the literacy film project, and they resigned in protest because the State Department essentially brought in these U.S. English language literacy experts and had them decide how you should teach Spanish to illiterate folks in Latin America. And these three Mexican teachers had been trying to give what they knew about how you teach literacy in Spanish, and they were just dismissed and ignored. And so they resigned in protest. And then one of them organized a whole campaign against the literacy films when they came to Mexico. And in some of the media that she helped produce, she was pointing out this problem, that this paternalistic approach. And she said, "I don't blame Disney. I don't think Disney didn't want this. This is the U.S. government," and kind of pushing back against that paternalistic attitude. And I am not an expert in the teaching of Spanish literacy, but even as somebody who can speak Spanish, I know that the way it was taught in these films would have been useless to anyone to learn how to speak and read or how to read in Spanish. So they're terrible films, but they're fascinating films.
You also referred at one point to South of the Border, and there's an effort to teach Donald Duck the samba. Maybe we can hear a little bit of that, and then you can explain what are we listening to.
Thank you. one of his first jobs on the screen was to teach it to Donald Duck. And here's an old Brazilian game called Caxangá. They say the Indians played it centuries ago. First, you sing the verse, then hum it, then play to the tempo in silence. It may look simple to Donald, but it's a fast game when you get going. The duck's a little slow at picking it up.
So the South of the Border with Disney is a documentary about the making of the feature-length films. And there is sort of Donald Duck becomes this figure who's, in both Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros, Donald Duck is the main U.S. figure, which I think is fascinating and ironic that Donald Duck is the character who, like, it's not Mickey, it's not maybe one of the more easily redeemable characters, it's Donald Duck and all of his foibles, which I don't think was an intentional humility, but I appreciate it in that. And so he goes about South America, learning about the Americas. One of the things that I find fascinating in that documentary is Disney in South of the Border with Disney, in an interview, he actually says, I didn't get any money from the U.S. government to do any of this, which is patently not true. But again, there's a kind of, he's separating himself. And the State Department allowed him to separate himself. In fact, they occasionally set it up so he would seem to be by himself without the State Department there helping him, because they knew that they had a bad reputation and he had a good reputation.
Well, and they wouldn't have wanted to make it clear it was propaganda.
Right, yes.
Which is hard to not look like if you're linked to a government.
Absolutely.
So with the Disney projects, you talk about how in some of the films, they talk about health conditions with drinking bad water, like with Ramon being kind of degenerate and a lighter-skinned Jose being less degenerate than Ramon. But what was the point of, you know, having things that had to do with health and sanitation and kind of spreading certain conditions through films? What was the point?
So I think there was a genuine concern about sort of failing bodies that were not strong enough to stand up to the Axis powers. I also think there's pure racism going on here, right? That there's an assumption that poverty or, in quotes, lack of development is not about structural conditions or place in experience in life, but is about individual choices. And so these literacy films, they're teaching how to read, again in quotes, but they're also trying to teach good hygiene habits. So the films are often about boiling water and washing your hands. And they teach that as fully connected. So because Jose makes good choices about boiling his water, he's healthy and strong, and he has the money he needs to have a clean house. And because Ramon drinks water straight from the stream, he's sick and he's lazy and he's pear-shaped and he can't effectively farm. Whereas Jose is like a Mexican Charles Atlas. He's all like, he can barely sit down because he's so muscular. And so this contrast is partially about creating a sense of who you should look to. And it's very much a U.S. ideal about what normal behavior is, what normal culture is. There's this is not about the literacy films, but there's an exchange about a film that I've never seen. But it's a very detailed critique of a film by an expert in the U.S. who is objecting because the original draft of the film is supposed to be about good farming methods to be sent to Mexico. And he's saying, wait, this barn is a U.S.-style barn, and you're talking about drinking milk, and are you sure that they drink milk? And so it's, you know, it's a person who's critiquing the assumption that everything about the U.S. way of life should transfer immediately into Mexico, when in fact it doesn't, and sort of pointing it out line by line through it. And I've never seen the final film. I don't know if it was changed from that, but just the fact that they would make it.
To make a film about farming in Mexico, but to use images from America and
exactly.
not try to be culturally competent, I
right.
guess you would say.
Yes, yes. What we would now call cultural competency was not going on here.
Is there any evidence that any of these Walt Disney feature films, documentaries, you know, the reading films, is there any evidence that it did some good? I mean, I can see the, it's easy to criticize them
Absolutely.
Because they're, you know, they're just laced with all kinds of problems, but did they do any good or did they make any changes? Did you find any evidence that people could point to, oh, I watched this film and it made me think this way?
You know, The archives hold a lot of presumed kind of magical evidence, right? Like, oh, these people completely were changed. They learned to read because of these films. That I think we can set aside. I do think, though, that just take an Ecuadorian example. When the literacy film pilot testing program came to Ecuador, they partnered with a group of newspaper or a journalists organization that was already doing a literacy project. And in that context, the Ecuadorian newspapers were able to use that partnership to promote the efforts that they were doing, that they were already doing. And so they, in that moment, they took the fame of Disney and used it to create more awareness within their own borders of their own efforts. And I would say that's a positive. Now, because I have the expertise in Ecuador, I have to acknowledge that that was a state and elite-run literacy project. At the exact same time, indigenous communities in Ecuador were doing literacy projects because in Ecuador at the time, you couldn't vote unless you were literate. And so they had literacy programs going on among indigenous people so that they could begin to have political power. And of course, those projects were often suppressed and met with violent resistance at the same time that the Unión Nacional de Periodistas was getting praise and accolades for its literacy projects. So, you know, nothing is perfect. But I do think people were able to use their relationship with Disney to move needles on social projects in Latin America. I think probably most of the positive came from people on site being able to leverage that for themselves and less from the U.S. imposing itself. But I would, of course, there are people who would say this made a difference for me, because that's always true. There's always a little bit of difference.
You call your last chapter Size Matters, and we're going to talk about size and scope and magnitude when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties.
That's John Legend singing America the Beautiful at the Super Bowl. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Krista Olson, and we are talking about her book, American Magnitude, Hemispheric Vision and Public Feeling. I think, you know, most of us, when we hear a song like America the Beautiful or God Bless America or, you know, a lot of the sort of patriotic songs, we're used to kind of seeing the scope of America, you know, from sea to shining sea and majestic mountains and all the landscape, all the topography of the entire country is sort of visually in our head when we hear those words. But in your book, you're sort of calling into question whether we've kind of, I guess, whether we're full of ourselves. let me just read a couple of sentences, Krista, from your book. You write, "The United States was conceited, overbearing, insensitive, and even destructive. Excessive self-regard impeded its vision, and its presumption of particular importance made it a terrible neighbor." Now that I'm just a gentle
criticism.
Yeah,
yes.
But, you know, I think that's why I wanted to open with the John Legend version, and then that sort of indictment. And it seems like it's both things. It's both the sort of celebrating the beauty and history and scope of the country, and at the same time, standing back and criticizing it. Can you talk about that dichotomy? You know, can you be both patriotic and deeply critical?
Absolutely. And you know, I'm somebody who I grew up, my mom is a Lutheran church organist and choir director, and so music has always been really important to me. And, you know, I can listen to John Legend sing America the Beautiful and feel that swell, right? That sense of, yeah, I do. There is such beauty here, and there is such a deep connection to the land and such a deep connection to my family's history and to the people I love here in this country. I would like the United States of America to be its best self, you know? And I think that that's a call that any true patriot can have for their own place of origin. But I also think about the, and I'm not going to remember the name of the songwriter. It's a song set to the tune Finlandia that says, you know, but other lands have sunlight too and clover and skies are everywhere as blue as mine, right? So, yeah, it is a classic thing of nationalism to say my country is great. You know, I referenced that I studied Ecuador and wrote about Ecuadorian nationalism. Ecuador is this tiny little country in South America. They lost a bunch of their land in the 1940s to Peru. And there was a whole campaign about being great through art that kind of took the place when a great small nation became a phrase that one of their writers would use. Greatness is a common trope of nationalism. And so we're not unusual in that sense. And I don't think it's strange to feel that way. When Donald Trump was elected, lo, these many years ago, people debated whether he was an aberration, people on the left, I should say, whether he was an aberration or a continuance of U.S. politics. And I am not a political scientist or a deep student of the U.S. presidency, but my money is on the continuation point. And I think American Magnitude really helps demonstrate that. So in the conclusion of the book, I talk a bit about the Trump presidency in retrospect, and the ways that Donald Trump's concern about size, about the size of crowds, about the importance of what he was doing is sort of a limit case of a larger U.S. obsession with being the biggest, the best, you know, the city on a hill. That has its roots in the colonial moment and then in Reagan and now, that there's a bit of a desire to be special. And I think maybe inevitably when you're really worried about being special and you really think that you are special, it can be hard to notice the ways that you are stepping on other people in the process. And so the United States has not been a great neighbor. And today, the United States is not a great neighbor, in particular to Mexico. I think people would also say Mexico isn't always a great neighbor to the United States. But if you're going to say we're the best and the greatest and the strongest and the most economically powerful, don't you also have some amount of obligation to be the better neighbor? We don't follow through on that part of it. We claim the greatness, but we don't claim the responsibility that comes with it. And I would also say that that responsibility is problematic in itself, right? The sort of laissez noblige of, well, we're great and powerful, so we should take care of you. That is kind of the way it's come across. And our neighbors don't appreciate that. I certainly wouldn't appreciate it from my own neighbors.
You write in your book, American magnitude was and is premised on a normative white settler vision. You talk about that and whether the phrase make America great again is in part saying make America more white again.
I feel like make America more white again would be, to the extent that white nationalist forces are allying themselves with the far right and with even some of the mainstream right at this point, that's a true statement for a lot of that thing, a lot of that trend. When I say that the greatness of the United States is premised on an assumption that is settler and white and normative, you know, I think in perhaps the most patriotic version of that kind of would resonate with Langston Hughes in the Make America Be America Again, America Never Was to Me, right? So if we're going to buy into that vision, then let's acknowledge we haven't gotten there and that we have things to do and that the habits of this country have often been driven by the needs and desires of white settler men. And you know, I always laugh that here I am in a time in history when scholars are not just writing about white men, and most of the major figures in my book, you know, Walt Disney, Hiram Bingham, Frederick Church, James K. Polk, right? I write a lot about white men, and part of what I'm interested in is how their views become the norm, become what people are acquiescing to. I mean, you mentioned way back at the beginning of the interview, the kind of that we forget the U.S.-Mexican War and California is just part of the country, and part of what I argue throughout the book is that's how it works. That in order to have the naturalness that we stretch from sea to shining sea, you have to forget the violence that made it happen. Or we could say this country is the shape it is because of a long and complex history. And people have fought on multiple sides of multiple issues to bring us to where we are. And if we only make it natural, if we only make it inevitable, then we only get the stories of the James K. Polks and the Donald Trumps about what this country is. But we can also have a much more interesting, much more complex, much more multivariate story of how we got here that includes the people who said no and who said, I don't fit in this vision, and vision doesn't work for me. And they have always been there.
Well, and you even mentioned that the phrase manifest destiny is actually probably coined by a woman who doesn't get credit for that phrase,
yes,
and that's
yes.
sort of the story often. I also remember long ago with University of the Year recording a series of programs with the late George Mossy on American masculinity and the way, and just even the fact that when they added a cowboy hat to the Marlboro Man, you know, to sell cigarettes, that it sold more cigarettes than other versions of the Marlboro Man. They're just putting that cowboy hat or the sort of John Wayne figure. Just this, you know, frontiersman, rugged individual, this kind of very macho man. Of course, that's a Spanish word, but, you know, this American man that was big and blustery and rude and bullying in a way that became part of American identity.
Yeah, and I think to the extent that we buy into that, we're buying into the need for being big and being great to be what matters. And I think it does. It's persuasive. It persuades me. I get caught up in magnitude, in the big concerts, the huge chords, the beautiful paintings. I get caught up. And so it's not, I don't think any of us need to be ashamed when we get caught in that. And I think it's worth noticing, oh, that has a history, and that there's a reason those appeals are appealing to us. What am I acquiescing to when I let that just take me over?
And if you could imagine a different noun besides magnitude, that would maybe suggest something that you'd like to see America moving toward. Mm-hmm. It would be American what?
Oh, I wish I had a good answer for that. So at the end of the book, I talk a little bit about what comes after or instead of magnitude. Because it can't just be small, right? So the answer to grand isn't small, or to important isn't unimportant, because that's also trafficking in magnitude. If we make ourselves small or like diminish ourselves, we also deny the great strength and opportunity that we have. And I think especially in our moment of deep ecological danger, to pretend that we don't have potential is a bad idea. We actually can make a difference, and so we should. But so as I've been thinking about what comes next or after or better, I think a lot about partiality and about messiness. That it's not about getting it right every time or having had the right track, the right trajectory. It's about seeing the good that you do in little ways and about acknowledging the ways you go astray and sort of having that partiality. It's also for me about building relationships and thinking of those relationships not as propaganda and not as kind of showing who we are, but as being the basis of who we are. The connections we build and the stories we tell about ourselves with others, to me, are the best way forward. So what does it mean to be not the most American of the Americas, but to be among our neighbors?
A different kind of good neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah.
A genuinely good neighbor.
A genuinely good neighbor.
Whatever that means, but I would
a good
assume
neighbor.
It means a more reciprocal
yes.
relationship.
Yeah.
Not a us, them, but a we.
Yeah. And, you know, I think my brain immediately goes to foreign policy on that. And I don't think that there's much hope of truly reciprocal foreign policy, because foreign policy is necessarily invested in, I mean, any country's foreign policy has to be about that country before it's about other countries. But I do think that the networks and organizations and coalitions that people build across borders are a great source of hope. And there are so many amazing organizations all over the Americas that are doing profound work on every single issue that confronts us. And they, you know, not everybody's going to know the names of those organizations. They're not going to become as famous as the Arsenal of Democracy speech or the, or Walt Disney. But they're working away. And I think finding the place, the people who are working away in our own communities and in relationship with others is, to me, the way forward from a politics rooted in magnitude.
My guest has been Krista Olson, author of American Magnitude. Thanks for joining me on
Thank
this
you so
program.
Much for
Very
having
eye-opening.
Me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Air. And I think we'll go out on Woody Guthrie, This Land Is My Land.
There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. The sign was painted, said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me.